Well, brethren, good morning once again to those of you across in the colonies, as we humorously sometimes say, and good afternoon, of course, those of you over here in England. We're continuing with our study through the book of Acts, and I think today will be the second last time we go through it. Next week, hopefully, if things go according to plan, God willing, we will complete the entirety of the book of Acts, and I think that'll be quite encouraging. That means that in the past 12 months we'll have done the entirety of the book of Genesis, the whole of Exodus, and almost now finishing the book of Acts. So that's, I think, not too bad over a 12-month period. So we pick up our Bibles and open them to Acts chapter 21, and we're beginning where we left off last week at verse 27. You may recollect that what had happened in the previous couple of three chapters, Paul was making his way speedily back to Jerusalem. He wanted to be there for the Feast of Pentecost, the Feast of the First Fruits. But on the way there, he had been warned a number of times by various prophets and prophecies that when he would get there would be some difficulties awaiting. And in fact, he would end up in chains in custody. Now, whether he was being warned in a sense that it's better not to go, or just being prepared for what was to come, we're not too sure. But Paul, being Paul, went on anyway. So, verse 27. And when the 7 days were almost ended, this is of a particular vow that had been taken, the Jews from Asia, that would be like, you know, Greece and Turkey and so on, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against the people, the law, and this place," you know, the temple. "And furthermore, he also brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." So the Jewish people, particularly those from Asia Minor, where Paul had spent quite some time, some years in fact, preaching and teaching, they recognized Paul and thought, "Here he is. Here's the guy causing all the trouble, and he's actually here in God's temple. This is absolutely atrocious." And so they bring all the people together and they say, "Look, he's actually defiled the temple." Verse 29, "For they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian with him in the city of Jerusalem, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple." And of course, Trophimus, being from Ephesus, an Ephesian, would have been a Gentile. And to bring a Gentile right into the highest portion of the temple was actually a capital offense. The temple was quite a big edifice altogether. There was the temple proper at the very top, but you climbed up to it through various terraces and so on, and down the bottom was quite a large court called the Court of the Gentiles, and Gentiles could go in there all right, but then you would go up some steps to a higher terrace, a higher level, and so on and so forth. And at a certain point there were big signs that said that anybody, any Gentile, or anybody who brings a Gentile past this particular part, it can be and will be put to death. So as far as these Jews were concerned, they could see Paul up there, and they assumed, wrongly, that he brought some Gentiles in with him. So therefore, as far as they were concerned, kill Paul and anybody else they can find there as well. Verse 30, "And all the city was disturbed, and the people ran together, seized Paul, and dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut." So what they did was grabbed hold of Paul, dragged him out of the into the outer court area, and then shut the gates between the outer court and the more important parts. Now, as they were seeking to kill him, verse 31, so in some ways, you know, the Jewish people don't mess about. They've got an idea in their head here that this guy is defiling their holy temple, as if they weren't. And so they grabbed Paul and matter of minutes, they're just going to beat his brains out. As they were seeking to kill him, news came to the commander of the garrison, the fort, that overlooked the temple area, that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. And it's hard to imagine in some ways, you know, from our vantage point today looking back, but this city of Jerusalem, which had got many, many more visitors, like almost tourists, because this was Pentecost season, there were many people who visited Jerusalem, you know, for the holy day, so the hotels were full, the motels were full, there were campsites and RVs parked everywhere. I mean, this place was heaving with humanity, and the poor old commander's busy, you know, probably watching some afternoon TV program, and here's the entire town is in complete uproar. And so verse 32, he immediately took soldiers and the centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. So they sort of, oops, it is he. So here comes the military, the guys with the machine guns and so on. So they stopped what they're doing just in case. And then the commander came near and took him. And he could tell this guy must be a real rogue, because here's these religious Jews busy beating somebody up. So he must be, as far as the commander is concerned, he must be a bad un of some sort. And commanded him to be bound with two chains. That would be like a chain to one soldier, and then a chain to a second soldier. So there's Paul, probably with his, you know, his nose bleeding, a black eye, a cauliflower ear, his clothes torn half off his body, chained to one soldier on his right, another soldier on his left. Just as had been prophesied, by the way, the man would be bound, it said. And the commander asked who he was and what he had done. And some among the multitude cried one thing, and some another, which is standard practice of multitudes. Nobody knew what they were doing, just beat this guy up. And when he could not ascertain the truth, because of the tumult, he commanded him to be taken into the barracks. And when he reached the stairs, he had to be carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. So it looks like, you know, when they saw Paul being taken away, once again they turned even more violent, trying to sort of grab hold of him. And so the soldiers had to pick Paul up virtually above their heads and carry him away from them, while the people still heaving and surging, trying to get hold of this guy and kill him. And you can only assume, I think, that, you know, Satan and Satan's demons were extremely active there. I've mentioned many times, in very large crowds, you do have to be careful. It does seem there's this sort of a, you know, crowd psychology, or perhaps that demons find it more easy to stir up crowds, and people start to follow almost mindlessly. And here's a bunch of people, most of them hadn't got a foggiest idea what they were doing, but some guy should be killed, and let's get close and beat him up. For the multitude of the people followed after, crying, "Away with him!" Pretty much as they shouted to about Jesus earlier on. And as Paul was about to be led into the barracks, into, you know, relative safety, he said to the commander, "May I speak to you?" And he replied, "Oh, can you speak Greek?" And the commander was obviously quite surprised. You know, Paul, as we can imagine, didn't look particularly good at this stage, all bedraggled and bloodied, and bits of his clothing, you know, hanging, trailing along the floor, and didn't look a very, you know, prepossessing individual. And clearly the commander was a bit taken aback. "Oh, you can speak Greek? Oh, I didn't expect that. Are you not the Egyptian who some time ago raised an insurrection and led the 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness?" You see, the commander thought he'd recognized him. He thought, "Surely you're that wild Egyptian, the one who's the sort of senior bandit in a bunch of cutthroats. Aren't you the one that, you know, was busy leading out that army of assassins, busy killing people and so on?" But Paul said, "No, absolutely not. I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city. And I implore you, permit me to speak to the people." Excuse me. And of course, Tarsus, I think we mentioned before, was quite a civilized, cultured city. And if Paul is a citizen of Tarsus, like he says, he's got a certain amount of status. He's not some Egyptian ragbag that's busy leading cutthroats about, nothing of the sort. So it seems like the commander thought, oh well, perhaps if he can speak to the crowd, who are still busy surging backwards and forwards and shouting and throwing things around and boulders and so on, perhaps he can calm them down. Verse 40. So when he had given him permission, Paul stood on the stairs, which was being carried up towards the barracks, and motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great silence, he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, saying. So, you know, Paul stands there, perhaps a sorry-looking specimen at this moment, you know, holds his hands up, and eventually all the people sort of quiet down and it gets very quiet, and now Paul is able to, you know, speak to them. And perhaps at this stage Paul thinks, you know, when I explain who I am and my background and pedigree, perhaps they'll understand and listen. If that's what he thought, he was, of course, sadly mistaken. Chapter 22, verse 1. Men, brethren, and fathers, hear my defense before you now. And when they heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they kept all the more silent. It was like, oh, he's speaking to us in our holy mother tongue, you know, Hebrew. I guess Paul could have spoken in Greek, and they would have understood, because Greek was pretty much the lingua franca. It was the common language of the Roman Empire. And so Paul could have used that, but he was being, in a sense, quite clever. If he uses Hebrew, they're more likely to pay attention, because, after all, it's their own language and the language of the Scriptures. And then he said, I am indeed a Jew. And, of course, while he's doing this, don't forget, the poor old commander can't understand a word, because he certainly didn't speak Hebrew. So he just sees Paul talking in this Jewish language to the people who are all at this stage listening, and the commanders get no idea whatsoever what Paul's talking about. I'm indeed a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city, here in Jerusalem, at the feet of Gamaliel. And of course that was a tremendous commendation. Gamaliel was probably one of the most famous rabbis and teachers of Judaism that you could have found. So to say that you were actually, you know, taught by and were a student of Gamaliel, it gave Paul, in a sense, you know, some of the highest credentials. Taught according to the strictness of our father's law, and was zealous toward God, as you all are today. So Paul starts to establish that, you know, look, people, if you want to look at a good Jew, you know, I'm one. I've got a tremendous background. I was actually brought up here in Jerusalem, which many of you weren't. I was taught by Gamaliel, which certainly most of you weren't. And I've been zealous towards God, just as you are today. Verse 4, I persecuted this way to the death. And so he recounts his rather unfortunate past, that he actually did persecute the brethren to death. Binding and delivering into prisons both men and women, and also the high priest bears me witness, and all the council of the elders, that would be the Sanhedrin, from whom I also received letters to the brethren, and went to Damascus to bring in chains, even those who are there, to Jerusalem to be punished. So Paul's more or less saying, look, you want to find a Jewish zealot, you're looking at one. You know, I actually went out and persecuted these Christians to the death. It didn't matter whether they were men or women. And I don't know whether that would include, you know, teenage girls or whatever. But Paul had a rather sorry past. And he was zealous, but not according to knowledge. And of course, you know, there'll be people who are going to be very religious in our time, who will think, as they harass and chase the true Christians and martyr some, that they're doing God a service, and they'll be genuine. They will be, in many cases, absolutely sincere, but they'll be absolutely deceived, as indeed Paul had been. You know, Paul was zealous, Paul was sincere, but what was he doing? He was actually taking the sons and daughters of the living God, who had repented and given their lives to Jesus Christ, and he was, look, it says there in verse 5, he was bringing them in chains, men and women, young and old, to be punished, and punished frequently meant actually executed for their beliefs. And verse 6, now it happened, as I journeyed and came near Damascus about noon, suddenly A great light from heaven shone around me, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And, you know, perhaps Paul might have had a sneaky feeling, but he wasn't sure. And he said, I answered, who are you, Lord? He knew this person, whoever it was a Lord. That went without saying. It's a person that can sort of blow you off your horse onto the ground and blind you at noon with this intense brilliance. Certainly was somebody you had to admit was going to be your Lord and Master, but he wasn't too sure perhaps exactly who the individual was. And he said to me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. Now those who were with me indeed saw the light and were afraid, but they did not hear the voice of him who spoke to me. So I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, arise and go into Damascus, and there you'll be told all things which are appointed for you to do. And since I could not see for the glory of that light, because he was effectively blinded for a few days, being led by the hand of those who were with me, I came into Damascus. Now, of course, in a sense, for Paul, who had been a zealous and a rather arrogant, super-duper self-righteous person, now he's blinded. The people around him haven't a clue what's going on, because they can hear certain sounds, perhaps like thunder rumbling, but they can't make out any words. They don't know what's happening to Paul, and suddenly the guy stands up, and he just put his hands in front of him and can't find anything, and they realize that, oh, Saul's lost his sight. And so they have to, take him by the hand and lead him, moving slowly because he can't see, all the way into Damascus. Quite a sort of a humbling experience for the man to become eventually the Apostle Paul. Then one Ananias, a devout man according to the law, having a good testimony with all the Jews who dwelt there, came to me. And so Paul explains to these people that, I was actually met by another very well recognized, solid Jew. And he stood and said to me, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that same hour, I looked up at him. So miraculously, Paul's vision was restored. Then he said, the God of our fathers has chosen you that you should know his will and see the just one and hear the voice of his mouth. For you will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. And now, why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. So Paul recounts basically, his conversion, his road to Damascus experience. And of course, when Ananias comes to him, Ananias says, look, it's time you're baptized. Obviously God's calling you. He's going to explain to you all the things you're going to have to do on his behalf, why you've been called, what your mission is. But come on, let's get you into the water to be immersed and submerged to wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. And then verse 17, then it happened, when I returned to Jerusalem, so this was some little time later, and was praying in the temple. So, Paul, in a sense, continues to demonstrate to his audience that he's got nothing particularly against the Jews. Even after his conversion, even after this miraculous experience, even after his baptism in the name of the Lord, whom, of course, he's not named yet, he says, you would find him in Jerusalem. And where? Right back in the temple where he was praying. And, of course, that should go down quite well with this audience, because Paul's saying, I didn't run away from the temple. I've not turned my back on, Jewish customs just for the sake of it. Verse 18, and saw him saying to me, so that tells us that, Paul actually saw Jesus. It says, I saw him saying to me, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me. So in this trance, Paul actually got to see Jesus. That's what it says. I saw him saying to me, so Paul is in the temple, he's praying, he falls into this strange sort of trance in which he has a vision in which he sees, you know, Jesus, the Messiah, talking to him. And Jesus says, look, get out of there quickly. They're just not going to listen to you, Paul, move out. Verse 19, so I said, Lord, they know that in every synagogue I imprisoned and beat those who believe on you. You know, I put them in prison and I actually physically beat up on those people that were believers. And when the blood of your martyr, or your witness, Stephen, was shed, guess what? I also was standing by, consenting to his death, and indeed guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. And Paul may have meant that, well, surely, Lord, when people realize my background and see how I've been changed, they're willing to listen to me. But if that's what Paul, in his naivete, thought, of course, he was proven many times later to be totally wrong. And Jesus certainly wasn't fooled. Verse 21, he said to me, depart, you know, get out, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles. And that was the magic word that created the next uproar. And they listened to him until this word, the word Gentiles, and then they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live. Then, as they cried out and tore off their clothes and threw dust into the air, so whoops-a-daisy, you know, Paul had held them in his grasp for quite a while, recounting his Jewish background and history. I'm quite impressed by that, Paul. And then his special miraculous vision, they're willing to listen to that a little bit longer. And back in the temple praying, happy enough to listen to Paul on that basis. But then when Paul's told by this Lord, forget these people in Jerusalem, you're going off to preach to the Gentiles, at that point, oh dear, that's too much. The Jewish people, in a sense, didn't mind Gentiles sort of becoming into the Judaistic religion. They could cope with that. But the fact that Gentiles could come to the Lord without first becoming Jews, that was too much, you know. And so they get really uptight and exploded into anger and shouting. And there we go again. Verse 24, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging, so that they might know why they shouted so against him. Because, of course, to the commander, he's now utterly befuddled. This guy was talking in Hebrew to the Jewish people. They've listened quite happily for a while. Then he said something, then uproar once again. So the poor guy has no idea what Paul's on about or what this problem is. He's going to find out. And, you know, the way they found out was they tortured you until you explained what was behind it all. So to examine under scourging means they're going to sort of start, you know, lashing Paul's naked back until he blurts out what all the trouble is. Seems a strange approach, but it's a strange world in some ways. Verse 25, and as they bound him with thongs to get scourged and whipped and take the flesh off his bones, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? And of course, Paul had them there, because in fact it was totally unlawful. And should you actually scourge a Roman, you yourself could be put to death. The Roman citizens were extraordinarily well protected by the laws of Rome. There's all sorts of stories about, I think there's one about some Roman somewhere was crucified in a particular town, and the Roman Empire, you know, virtually razed the town to the ground, because you don't tackle a Roman citizen without, you know, due legal process, as they would say. And here's Paul, you know, he's not even been to a court yet, and he's about to be scourged, and he says, just a moment, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? Just a little casual question. And when the centurion heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, uh-oh, take care what you do, for this man is a Roman. And of course, oops-a-daisy, suddenly pennies are dropping all over the place. Then the commander comes rushing along and said to him, tell me, I can't believe this, are you a Roman? And the Greek actually does emphasize the word you. Are you a Roman? Because, you know, here's Paul, that disheveled, bloodied face, a few bruises there, sorry-looking specimen at this moment. And the commander can't believe that surely this ragamuffin before me can't be a Roman citizen, can he? And Paul said, yes. And the commander answered, with a large sum of money I obtained, you know, my citizenship. That may have been bribery or something. But Paul said, oh, well, but I was born a Roman citizen. Then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him. Sort of all stepped back in a sort of shock horror because, uh-oh, this could be severe trouble. So I wasn't going to scourge him, not me. No, it wasn't my fault. I'm innocent, I'm following orders. And they all sort of stepped back about 6 feet, leaving Paul still tied up there. And the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman and because he had bound him. Because even to bind a Roman without proper cause could get you, like in his case, probably court-martialed or himself scourged or who knows what. So it was like all of a sudden, you know, Paul was hanging there by the thongs and all these people are just sort of standing away back thinking, oh no, we are in serious trouble here. If this goes to the wrong ears, you know, we're in desperate trouble. Verse 30. The next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priests and all their council, that's the Sanhedrin, to appear, and brought Paul down and set him before them. So he figured that there's got to be something here. I mean, we can't scourge him. We better not even leave him bound up because he is a Roman citizen. And we don't know why Paul was a Roman citizen exactly. Being born in Tarsus didn't make you a Roman citizen automatically. The belief is probably that perhaps Paul's father or maybe his grandfather had done some particular important service to the Roman emperors before, had been created a citizen, and if that was the case, it would run in the family. And so Paul would become a Roman citizen by birth into his particular family. And it's quite, I mean, Paul's quite an impressive individual in many ways when you think about it. He was multilingual. He could speak various languages. He was raised at the very heart of Judaism. He was taught by a man like Gamaliel. He seemed to be very well known socially by many of the sort of governors and so on. Hugely zealous individual. And of course, when he was called and converted, it turned out to be perhaps, who knows, the greatest of the apostles. So, quite an individual. Chapter 23 and verse 1. So, you know, the commander has now decided to try and bring this to a conclusion. I'll call down the Sanhedrin, these Jewish leaders, and say, okay, we're going to have like a court session. Now you tell me, what is this all about? There must be some reason why this guy is at the center of all this uproar and this mob. Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Which, you know, isn't at all right, is it? This is like a sort of a, you know, court scenario where a person's being examined to find out the truth and to present his case and have it heard before the officials. And here, somebody who's part, you know, the legal process actually, you know, instructs that you get punched on the jaw. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, for you sit to judgment according to the law, and you command me to be struck contrary to the law? I mean, you hypocrite, you. And those who stood by said, do you revile God's high priest? And then Paul said, oh, I did not know, brethren, that he was a high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. And so it seems quite likely that, you know, Paul had been away from Jerusalem for several years. And according to history, there's a lot of politics anyway in the priesthood. There are always high priests are coming and are going. And it's quite likely that Paul didn't particularly recognize Ananias as being high priest. He didn't apologize, if you notice. Paul simply said, well, I didn't know he was one, first of all. And perhaps implying that, well, how would you know if he acts like that? It's not very good behavior. And secondly, he says it is true that you shouldn't speak evil of the ruler of your people. So he didn't actually say, but I'm sorry, you know, for saying what I did say. And in many ways, you know, what Paul said there, you know, verse 3, God will strike you, you whitewash wall, was, you know, almost a prophecy, it seems, because Ananias was not a very nice man. The historians of the time say that Ananias was he stole the tithes, even the priesthood. And it says that many of the junior priests in the temple were very close to starvation. They didn't have enough to eat because, you know, the big head honcho, the high priest Ananias, used to sort of steal all the tithes to himself. And also he was known to have employed assassination and violence against other people. And it says that God will strike you, you whitewash wall. Well, about 5 years after the events, you know, written here, Ananias was actually chased down by other Jewish fighters for other reasons and was himself slain. So he was executed or assassinated himself just a few years later. So he wasn't a very good specimen. Well, you know, sometimes religious people are like that. I think we said before, we not that, you know, we don't have a religion. Religion is something that you might do 1 hour a week or 2 hours a week. Religion is having all the candles and the ceremony in some sort of big building. Religion, if you're certain parts of the Muslim community, is tying, you know, sticks of dynamite around your waist, walking into a crowd of children and blowing everybody up. That's religion. You and I are not called to be religious. We are called to follow God's way of living, to follow the way that Jesus Christ has described, and he is our example. We are to follow in his footsteps, and that's what Paul was doing. But sometimes, you know, some of the worst people you'll come across are religious people. And Ananias is a pretty good example. Very religious. You know, amen, brother. But, you know, used violence, stole money, and ultimately got his just deserts. Verse 6. But when Paul perceived that one part of the council were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, crying out in the sense of shouting out, because one imagines this being a bunch of Jews that are already debating and disputing quite actively at this stage about the whole circumstances. You know, the old saying that where there's two Jews, there'll be three opinions. The Jews have got certain delight for argumentation, and so Paul must have heard them debating already on their seats about various aspects, and he recognized from, I can see that there's quite a crowd here of Sadducees and another bunch of Pharisees. So he shouts out really above all their voices and cries out, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged. Which, of course, was actually very true. You know, the resurrection of the dead, first and foremost, was of Jesus the Messiah, who had been resurrected from the dead and was leading the way, you know, whereby in the fullness of time, you know, many more will be raised from the dead. And that's the hope that we all have. For most people, the hope has been a resurrection, you know, from the dead. And for us at this latter time, I guess our hope is that we'll, you know, live on to Christ's glories appearing and be changed at that time. So Paul says, I'm a Pharisee. My dad was a Pharisee, by the way, folks. And it's because of the resurrection of the dead that I'm actually here being judged. And when he had said this, verse 7, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. And Paul was being pretty cute here. I think he probably recognized, perhaps naively, he thought initially that, well, I'll preach to these guys and I'll tell them my background once again, and I'll tell them about my amazing conversion, and then they'll listen to me, and then they'll understand, and some of them might actually, you know, come to God and to Jesus and so on. But, you know, when it started off being punched in the jaw on the instructions of the high priest, Paul probably thought, well, that's put paid to that idea, and that's not the sort of environment we appear to be in today. And then he heard the Sadducees and Pharisees fussing and debating. He thought, oh, well, I can see one way out of here. So he throws in this comment about the resurrection of the dead. And then, of course, the Sadducees and Pharisees, you know, they really get going. Verse 8, for the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, and, what's more, no such thing as angels, no such thing as spirit. But the Pharisees confess both, which is an interesting insight into what you might call the Jewish religion. You know, people think the Jews all believed exactly the same thing. They didn't. The Pharisees didn't believe the same thing. The Pharisees fighted and fussed among each other over everything you could think of. And in fact, you know, the Jews just liked debating and fussing and so on. And so the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection. Impossible. Doesn't happen. Don't be stupid. There's no such thing as angels. Come off it. Spirit, get away with you. But the Pharisees, of course, they believe in the resurrection and in angels and spirits. Then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes, who were of the Pharisees' party, arose and protested, saying, we find no evil in this man. What he's saying is perfectly sensible to us. But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God. And when there arose a great dissension, an almighty tumult, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, because the Pharisees are grabbing him, saying, he's one of us. And they're saying, he's, let's kill that guy. So they've all got hold of him, and, you know, there's, you know, 30 pulling him one way and 30 pulling him another way, and poor old Paul's about to be sort of torn into pieces. And the commander says, oh my word, they're at it again. And commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him back into the barracks. So, you know, Paul had a pretty eventful sort of life. It does show you the difficulty, of course, of actually going into any religious group of any sort and trying to preach the truth to them. It's going to be a rather hair-raising sort of ride if you do that. Verse 11, but the following night the Lord stood by him, so Jesus the Messiah, you know, turned up in person with Paul and said, be of good cheer, Paul. And I guess that implies that perhaps Paul was a bit sort of down in the mouth at this stage, perhaps still somewhat bruised and from his earlier episodes, and perhaps thinking that, well, that was a waste of time, that was. I was warned not to come to Jerusalem, but, you know, I came anyway. And here I am, you know, in this sort of dungeon in the barracks and nearly torn apart, and, oh my word, what's going to happen to me? And perhaps he's feeling rather sorry at this stage. It's all looking rather bleak. And, you know, Jesus obviously knew that, so he turned up in person, which I guess would be, you know, rather encouraging, and said, cheer up, Paul, be of good cheer, for as you've testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome. And, of course, Paul must think, whoa, hang on a second, Jesus, thanks for that. That's very helpful. That's very comforting. That's great news. So, I'm not going to die here in Jerusalem, am I? All right. I'm going to actually bear witness at Rome. Ah, so there's more work for me to do. And I guess for all of us, you know, knowing that, you know, God's got a work for us and a commission for us and a job he wants us to do, that gives you a great sense of purpose. And so Paul thought, that's it. I can stop worrying. I might be here, you know, in prison, but I've got a future because I'm going to end up even yet in Rome, the capital of the Roman Empire. And no doubt I'll be preaching the kingdom of God when I get there. So that was good news for the Apostle Paul. Moving down then to verse 12. And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. So you've got to hand it to the Jews. You know, they're pretty zealous themselves. They're going to take this conspiratorial vow that, well, we're going to kill this guy. He's not leaving this place alive, that's for sure. And what's more, we're going to take this super-duper oath. Okay, lads, we'll bind ourselves together. We're not going to drink a glass of water. Not going to eat a hamburger until Paul is dead and in his grave. And they all say, yes, amen. Now, there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. And then they came to the chief priests and elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a great oath that we will eat nothing until we have killed Paul. Now you, therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him. but we are ready to kill him before he comes near. And of course the chief priest said, we can't be a party to that. That's dishonest and illegal. Go and repent and say three Hail Marys and two Our Fathers. But of course not, because these guys are a bunch of crooks, hypocrites, like many religious people are. Verse 16, and when Paul's sister's son, so Paul had a sister, at least one, this would be his nephew, I guess, heard of their ambush, and, you know, not sure how he heard about it. Perhaps it was being discussed in the pub or something. But, Paul's sister's son found out about their ambush. He went and entered the barracks and told Paul. So although Paul was there, he obviously was allowed, you know, some leeway, and certainly allowed some visitors, and his nephew, being family, was clearly allowed to come and speak to him. Then Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him. So he took him and brought him to the commander and said, Paul the prisoner, quite a title, isn't it? Paul the prisoner. Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you. And then the commander took him by the hand. The Greek implies, you know, just gently, you know, on his shoulder, and take him off into a private area and said, what is it that you have to tell me? Implications are the commander was actually a relatively decent sort of fellow. Obviously, he was a military man and had to sort of control the rather unruly Jews, but not an unpleasant individual. And he was quite gentle with this young man and said, okay, you got something you want to say to me privately and confidentially. Well, what is it? Verse 20, and he said, the Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire more fully about him. But do not yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for the promise from you. So the commander let the young man depart and commanded him, tell no one that you have revealed these things to me. So that leaves the commander with okay, I have to deal with this now. We can't have a Roman citizen, put to death by a bunch of Jewish bandits. Verse 23, and he called for two centurions. I remember centurions were over 100 soldiers apiece. He called for two centurions, saying, prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen. So that's 470 altogether. That's quite a large bunch of military men, to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night. That would be 9 o'clock in the evening to us. And provide mounts to set Paul on and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. So I'm going to get Paul out of Jerusalem straight away. It's just getting too dangerous here. Who knows what they'll try and do next. So the best thing to do is to get him right down to the governor. And so 470, nearly 500 soldiers, and Roman soldiers were no pushovers. They were, highly trained and quite vicious. So he put 500 of those to guard over Paul. And there's no question that Paul's going to get to his destination. He wrote a letter in the following manner. So a sort of covering note to go with Paul to Felix. Claudius Lysias. So we now know the name of this commander. His name is Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix. Greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Which is probably a slight bit of spin, I think, there. He certainly did learn he was a Roman, but when he was about to scourge the skin off his back. But nonetheless, it presents Claudius Lysias in a reasonably good light to Felix. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council, because I'm a man who does these things properly and in order. I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had done nothing charged against him worthy of death or chains. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you, and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. So that's moving the problem out of his hair and down towards Felix. So that's probably quite a good bit of sort of upwards delegation. Verse 31. Then the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris, which is about 40 miles from Jerusalem. And I've only ridden a horse once in my life, and that was probably for about about an hour altogether, and I suppose we covered perhaps 3 or 4 miles. Riding 40 miles on a horse sounds to me like quite a long, painful journey, I've got to say. And 40 miles in the night, so that's quite a good rapid journey. And the next day, they left the horsemen to go on with him and returned to the barracks, because that was most of the journey underway. No way the Jews would catch him now. When they came to Caesarea and had delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. And when the governor had read it, he asked what province he was from. And when he understood that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will hear you when your accusers also have come. You know, once they've arrived, then we can hear both sides and try and form, you know, a proper judgment. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium, a sort of a Herod's palace in Caesarea. So there'd be a room or something there that they could put, you know, Paul in, and he'd be quite secure there from any other Jewish, terrorists, whatever, and keep him safe until things will be done properly. Down now to chapter 24. Now, after 5 days, Ananias the high priest came down with the elders and a certain orator named Tertullus. It says a certain orator in my New King James Version. The meaning is more of a sort of a specialist prosecuting attorney. This was a top lawyer that he brought down. He was going to sort of, you know, nail Paul's skin to the mast. So this all the top guys turning up now with this well-known, highly recognized prosecuting attorney by the name of Tertullus. These gave evidence to the governor against Paul. It was all complete, you know, nonsense, just one lie after another. And when he was called upon, Tertullus began his accusation, saying, you know, this was the prosecutor, seeing that through you, you know, Felix, we enjoy great peace and prosperity being brought to this nation by your foresight, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. So you start off with a bit of crawling to the noble governor, Felix, who brings wonderful peace and prosperity to our nation because he's such a wonderful chap. In fact, he's just complete lies as well. It's all flattery because the historians tell us that Felix actually was born as a slave, and he was the only slave apparently that actually rose to become anything like a governor in the entire Roman history. But Tacitus, who was a Roman historian, says that Felix was a master of cruelty and lust, who exercised the power of a king with the spirit of a slave. He was always a petty-minded, nasty piece of work, but had quite a bit of power. He acted like a king, but his mind was a twisted, little, you know, mean mind. And as it says, he was a master of cruelty and lust. So he wasn't a nice character in the slightest. But, you know, Tertullus can hardly stand up and say, well, you're a complete waste of space, Felix. You're a nasty guy, but we want you on our side. So he starts off with a nice little bit of flattery and crawling. And then he carries on verse 4. Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear, by your courtesy, a few words from us, a typical lawyer. For we have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. You can't come to use the word, you know, Christians, because to mention, you know, the name Christ or Jesus would be just too much for them. But we know that Jesus was called a Nazarene because he came from Nazareth. And the followers of Jesus, as it says here, were known as the Nazarenes, who, of course, are called a sect. Verse 6, he even tried to profane the temple. Can you believe it, Felix? And we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law. But the commander Lysias came by and with great violence took him out of our hands. That's a lie, of course. Commanding his accusers to come to you. By examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him. And the Jews also assented, maintaining that these things were so. That's right, Felix. It's spot on, Felix. It's exactly what he'd been doing, Felix. And none of it was, I mean, it's, the whole thing is just baloney. Then Paul, after the governor had nodded to him to speak, answered, "Inasmuch as I know that you have been for many years a judge of this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because you may ascertain that it is no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship. I've only been there, you know, less than 2 weeks, and they neither found me in the temple disputing with anyone, nor inciting the crowd, either in the synagogues or in the city, nor can they prove the things of which they now accuse me." And of course, in a court of law, the key thing is evidence. And Paul saying, let's see one scrap of evidence of anything they've said about me. Verse 14. "But this, you know, I certainly do confess to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and the prophets." You know, I believe totally in what the Old Testament, the Old Covenant teaches. "And I live according to the way." Verse 15, "I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust." You know, sometime in the future, everybody will be resurrected at some stage. You know, the righteous, of course, to eternal life, and those that are incorrigibly wicked will be resurrected to meet their final fate in the second death. Verse 16, "This being so, I myself always strive to have a conscience without offence toward God and men." I mean, I don't go around trying to offend people. I try to get on with people. I'm courteous. And we've seen that in the last few chapters. You know, Paul, you know, by and large, didn't try to run down people and attack their beliefs. He preached what was true. He attempted to be tactful. And there was little you could actually say about Paul in that sense. He didn't go around just, you know, giving people raspberries and so on about keeping Christmas and so on. Something that perhaps occasionally we make mistakes in. We think we can bring people to the truth by attacking, you know, their beliefs, and it just doesn't work that way. If you preach what is true and say what's true, people can, you know, come to their own conclusions. Verse 17, "Now after many years I came to bring alms and offerings to my nation, in the midst of which some Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with a multitude nor with tumult. They ought to have been here before you to object if they had anything else, anything against me. Or else let those who are here themselves say if they found any wrongdoing in me while I stood before the council." You know, where's the evidence? You know, let's have somebody turn up and say something that's got, you know, real hard evidence to it. "Unless it's for this one statement which I cried out standing among them, concerning the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged by you this day." And I guess Paul was probably got one eye on the Pharisees, thinking it might work again. If I toss that into the conversation, perhaps once again I'll get the Pharisees and the audience here, you know, back on my side. "But when Felix heard these things, having more accurate knowledge of the way," it looks like, you know, Felix had got his ear to the ground. He'd already heard a significant amount about this Jesus, the Messiah, and this sect of the Nazarenes, and perhaps knew more about it than the Sanhedrin. He adjourned the proceedings and said, "When Lysias the commander comes down, I will make a decision on your case." So he put off a decision for another day. Verse 23. "So he commanded the centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty, and told him not to forbid any of his friends to provide for or visit him." So, you know, Felix, I think, understands a lot of what's going on here. He probably spots the jealousy among the Jewish Sanhedrin, recognizes there's really nothing in this. It's just a sort of debate about different aspects of the Jewish religion. There's nothing here that requires Paul really to be kept in prison. But politically, there might be some, you know, some mileage for me keeping him here. So I'll adjourn the hearing until Lysias comes down and we can get some more information. Meanwhile, perhaps I can find some way of making some money out of this. That's the way Felix operated. "And after some days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ." So once Drusilla arrives, Felix calls for Paul once again. Now, Drusilla was a daughter of one of the Herods. You remember the Herod that martyred the Apostle James, the Herod that was eaten by worms when he was busy showing how, you know, super duper he was, and an angel struck him and he was eaten up by worms. This was one of his daughters, Drusilla. And of course, you know, Herod was a Jew of sorts, and so Drusilla was Jewish, was married to Felix, and perhaps Felix had learned certain things about, you know, the Jewish way of doing things from his wife Drusilla. And in fact, you know, Felix, according to history, had three wives. This was his third wife, and Drusilla was a divorcee, having left her former husband. So between them, they had five, you know, marriages. And you know what Jesus said about this being a wicked and adulterous generation when he walked about? Well, you can see that, really. I mean, these two folk have been married umpteen times already. But anyway, Drusilla turns up, and Felix calls for Paul to hear more about the faith in Christ, in the Anointed One. Now, as he, Paul, reasoned about righteousness, of which, let's say, Felix was significantly lacking, self-control, of which Felix was significantly lacking, being on his third wife already and known to be busy killing people he didn't like and so on, and the judgment to come for immoral behavior, of which Felix was extremely familiar. So you can imagine that Felix would be sort of quite uncomfortable sitting in his chair listening to Paul preaching about righteousness, oops, self-control, oop, double oops, and judgment to come. Oh my word. Felix was afraid. One translation says trembled, because he recognized that I'm facing a decision here. But of course, Felix, you know, made, I guess, the wrong decision. He said, clear off for now, Paul. When I've got a more convenient time, I will call for you. Which, of course, is a great cop-out. And so Felix could perhaps have heard more, and but he didn't. Verse 26, meanwhile, he also hoped that money would be given him by Paul, that he might release him. He's always got an eye open for the fast buck, our friend Felix. And, you know, Paul's got a lot of friends, and he's quite well-known socially, Paul is, so maybe somebody come along and just offer me some nice gold coins, so we'll just keep him around for a while longer. And therefore, he sent for him more often and conversed with him. So it's probably fair to say that Felix had quite a good witness, you know, from the Apostle Paul, you know, over you know, a couple of years. Verse 27, but after 2 years, Porcius Festus succeeded Felix, and Felix, wanting to do the Jews a favor, left Paul bound. So, politician, you know, to the end. Along comes little Porky Festus. Chapter 25, verse 1. Now, when Festus, Porcius, little Porky, had come to the province, after 3 days, he went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Then the high priest and the chief men of the Jews informed him against Paul. And we've got to face it, they're quite good. They never let up, do they, these Jewish guys? You know, to the end of your days, they'll chase you. And they petitioned him, asking a favor against him, Paul, that he would summon him to Jerusalem while, of course, they lay an ambush along the road to kill him. And this wouldn't be the same guys, because, you know, they hadn't eaten for 2 years. They were long since gone. I read somewhere that you could be released from an oath if you got the high priest or somebody to sort of like forgive you. So I guess human nature being what it is, they probably did decide to get released from their oath when they found out that Paul was 100 miles away in the barracks at Caesarea. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea and that he himself was going there shortly. Therefore he said, let those who have authority among you go down with me and accuse this man to see if there is any fault in him. You think, you know, Paul, you know, it's been an interesting couple of 3 years in his life, and maybe he needed it. Perhaps he needed the break. You know, it's possible that, you know, any of us could just be so busy just going on and on and on and working and working and working, you know, burning the candle at the north end, the south end, and in the middle, and burn ourselves out. I mentioned, I think it was last time, about the you know, the minister in America who was in the letter answering department at Pasadena, and, you know, essentially had a breakdown. He just wore himself completely out, doing good. I mean, he was helping people and working with people and answering letters. And I think he said he wore out 4 or 5 Bibles in that time. But there was no let up, no break. And his life was so unbalanced that eventually he had a breakdown. And we know that Paul, you know, he'd done 3 complete missionary journeys. He'd preached everywhere. He'd been shipwrecked and, you know, beaten many times. It might be in a sense that God had intervened here in a rather strange way. You know, God works in mysterious ways, has wonders to perform. And here Paul is stuck, you know, in a prison, sort of, but he's given a fair amount of freedom within the prison. His friends and family can visit him. He can no doubt talk and preach one-to-one. And in a sense, you know, he's got a certain couple of years to, I won't say relax exactly, but a break in his otherwise, you know, rather busy life. Verse 6. And when he had remained among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. And the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, an official hearing, he commanded Paul to be brought. When he had come, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood about and laid many serious complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. Same old story. While he answered for himself, "Look, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I offended in anything at all. But Festus, wanting to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and there be judged before me concerning these things?" Then Paul, you know, figured out, hang on a second, you know, I escaped from Jerusalem only just a couple of years ago because of all the trouble up there, and this guy's asked me to go back up there? I don't think that's a wise move. Then Paul said, "I stand already at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I've done no wrong, as you very well know." You know, putting the onus back on Festus. "For if I'm an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I do not object to dying. But if there is nothing in these things of which these men accuse me, no one, including you, Festus, can deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar." So, you know, Paul knew the law, and he knew, in a sense, how to call upon the provisions of the law. And he could see here that perhaps Festus was wavering somewhat, might have been persuaded to send Paul back up to Jerusalem, in which case, you know, Paul perhaps was a bit nervous and thought that's not a good idea. And at the end of the day, he remembered that Jesus had told him, you know, "You will be in Rome. You will preach in Rome, Paul." So Paul says, "Look, nobody can send me back up there. I appeal to Caesar." And every Roman citizen had the legal right to get right in front of the emperor and have his case heard personally. And that's what Paul was doing. Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, the Sanhedrin, answered, "You've appealed to Caesar? To Caesar you shall go." And after some days, King Agrippa and Bernice came to Caesarea to greet Festus. This was Herod Agrippa II. The Herods were quite numerous. Sometimes you think there's only, you know, one Herod in the Gospels and the Book of Acts and so on, but there were quite a number of Herods. This was Herod Agrippa II, a man with a fascinating lineage. His great-grandfather was the Herod who killed all the babies in Bethlehem and tried to kill Jesus as a baby. That was his great-granddad. His grandfather was the Herod that slew John the Baptist and took his head off. And his father was the Herod that killed James the Apostle. So quite a family line, really, you know, killing babies in Bethlehem, John the Baptist, James the Apostle. And here's Paul thinking, uh-oh, this is the fourth Herod in a long line, and it's not looking too good in some ways. And so there's Herod Agrippa II and Bernice, who was his sister. And rumor has it there was an unhealthy relationship between Agrippa and Bernice. Came to Caesarea to greet Festus. When they had been there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There's a certain man left a prisoner by Felix, about whom the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me when I was in Jerusalem asking for a judgment against him. And I suppose we've got to realize that, you know, the chief priests and the elders were the sort of top politicians in the Israel of that time. So even though Festus and Felix and so on might not have believed a word they said, politically it was difficult to just totally ignore them. Verse 16, to them I answered, it is not the custom of the Romans to deliver any man to destruction before the accused meets the accusers face to face and has opportunity to answer for himself concerning the charge against him. Therefore, when they had come together without any delay, the next day I sat in the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought in. You see how efficient I am, King Agrippa. You know, in just a day, I'm up there and I'm about to listen to the case. When the accusers stood up, they brought no accusation against him of such things as I supposed. He was thinking they're going to be, you know, Paul's guilty of, you know, rape and murder and bank robbery and everything. And it turns out, verse 19, but it's some questions against him about their own religion, about one Jesus who had died, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. I mean, this is crazy. Verse 20, and because I was uncertain of such questions, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there be judged concerning these matters. But when Paul appealed to be reserved for the decision of Augustus, the emperor in Rome, I commanded him to be kept till I could send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I also would like to hear the man myself. Tomorrow, he said, you shall hear him. So the next day, when Agrippa and Bernice had come with great pomp, because that's the way that the Herods behaved, they were so superbly important, wealthy, and of course so loved by all the population, that they always arrived with tremendous pageantry and pomp, and had entered the auditorium with the commanders and the prominent men of the city, at Festus' command, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all the men who are here present with us, you see this man about whom the whole assembly of the Jews petitioned me, both at Jerusalem and here, crying out that he was not fit to live any longer. I mean, look at him. This is the man who the whole Jewish world is up in arms against. Just look at him. And when I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, you know, the Caesar, I decided to send him. I have nothing certain to write to my lord concerning him. You know, I don't even know what to say, really, because I can't figure out what this complaint is actually about. It's just beyond my understanding. Therefore, I have brought him out before you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the examination has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems to be unreasonable to send a prisoner and not specify the charges against him. Which I think is a good place to finish for today. But you can see, you know, poor old Festus, I'm going to send this guy to the emperor. The emperor's going to say, okay, what's the vitally important reason? What is the major crime which this man's being sent to me to judge? And at the moment, I can't do anything at all because I can't see any problem with the guy. And perhaps King Agrippa, when you've examined him and asked him, you know, pertinent questions, then you can give me some clue so that I don't send some stupid report to the emperor along with Paul, because he's got to go. He's asked to go, he's appealed to Caesar, and he's jolly well going to go. And okay, I think with that, we can conclude our Bible study for the week.